The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at TNTRadio.live. You're listening to The Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. Today, I have a table that is made out of a door in front of me with lots of beautiful surroundings and an old typewriter to my left, because I'm actually broadcasting live from the sunny but chilly island of Ibiza. I've come for a couple of days here. And it's reminding me, looking at this typewriter, about technology, about impacts, about uneven nature of development, and about the relationship between the so-called developed nations and developing nations, or just different countries at different stages of development, and what happens when we do certain things, when we have policies that have ramifications around the world. Now, recently, Toby Green and Thomas Farzi wrote a book all about this, when they wrote The COVID Consensus, from an internationalist left perspective, about the impact of the world's COVID-19 response, which they said had devastating consequences for democratic rights and the poor worldwide. And as the fortunes of the richest soared, nationwide shutdowns devastated small businesses, the working classes, and the global South's informal economies, leading to all sorts of terrible measures and impacts. Larry Elliott has given them accolades from The Guardian. The critic has called it an important book. Brave, Measured, and Essential, El Pais calls it, and many other commendations. Now, Professor Toby Green is Professor of Pre-Colonial and Lusophone African History and Culture. And after studying at King's University, and after studying philosophy, Toby worked as a writer and editor, publishing various books that have been translated into 12 languages. Now, he's got loads of accolades, and I'm not going to share them all with you, but you can see him online. More importantly, you should get the book that he's the co-author with Thomas Farzi on, called The COVID Consensus, because today, 3 years after lockdown with a day or two, we're talking to Toby about what that all means. Toby, thanks for joining us today.
Alan, it's really nice to be on your show, and I wish I was with you in Ibiza.
Well, looking at this typewriter, it reminded me just of, without kind of doing a parody of things, but just development and technology, and sort of what I used to think ideas on the left used to be about, which was transformation and improvement for the betterment of the poor and everyone, actually, wealth creation and freedom. Yeah. And privacy and all those ideas. And yeah, it seems like, but correct me if I'm wrong, Toby, when you wrote this book, partly it was because many on the left didn't seem to share the ideas that, you know, and the consequences of the things you were pointing out.
Yeah, I mean, the book has had a funny history, Alan. I wrote a first draft. Well, a first draft, I call it. It was almost like a first draft. There was a first edition, which was... which I wrote in because I was so distraught, frankly, and drafted at the end of 2020. It was drafted in lockdown two. Actually, funny story. I was with my family. We had to go to Spain for a family visit. We got caught up in the rush to the second lockdown, and at the end of October 2020, got out on the last flight to Stansted, and arrived as Johnson announced lockdown two. And it's a completely true story. I thought, God, you know, I've been trying to publish things and failing. Somebody had put me in touch, in fact, with an editor at the New York Times who'd shown a bit of interest. And then perhaps it won't surprise you and your listeners that didn't go any further. And anyway, then I just thought, right, I knew this publisher quite well at Hearst. And I wrote him a 3-line email. And then a week later, started writing the first edition. And drafted it through lockdown two. You know, the whole thing, the initial draft was written during lockdown two. And then, because like throughout that first year of 2020, it was already abundantly clear what the consequences of this were for inequalities, poverty, and what the risk ratio was of, and I've always been, quite clear about it. It's not that I think that COVID-19 is not a serious disease and can be, certainly for some people, but there is a risk benefit, a risk analysis which should be made about, who's going to be most at risk and what are the most appropriate measures in order to, you know, for them to be best protected? And does that involve a generic policy, which you apply to everybody? Or wouldn't you be better off actually, you know, focusing a smaller amount of resources, but at those people, which was, you know, the focus protection idea, which was the traditional idea, in fact. Anyway, so that had been my, and like, because the impacts were so clear and it was so contrary to everything I've, as you say, I thought an internationalist left perspective believed in, which was reducing inequality, making life better for the majority of people. I that was the perspective I wrote the first edition for with, and it came out in April 2021. And you know, in the UK, which is, you know, where I'm based, it was virtually completely ignored. Even though my previous book, as you kindly mentioned, you know, had been widely reviewed and received various what's-its, as I will call them now. but anyway, the fact of the matter was that, you know, nobody wanted to hear that discussion. So, you know, then I got even angrier in a way. And then I joined forces with Thomas, and, you know, and the second edition. You know, the first edition was, in a way, perhaps quite polite. You know, it didn't really... Well, because I think perhaps partly because I wrote it at a time when I'm thinking, well, you know, surely a reasoned argument looking at all this evidence as it was already clear will, you know, should, you know, make some people think, you know, think it's worth having a discussion about this. That didn't appear to be the case. So then, you know, I got angrier and, you know, joined forces with Thomas. And as you know, the second edition is perhaps not quite so polite, but, you know, I think tries to lay it on the line just as, you know, as best we can, as far as what we experienced, you know, how this turned out over the last few years.
Yeah, well, it's weighty and it deals with a lot. But just to be really slow and take a step back for a second, there's been many different views and even what left and right even means today. But some will say it's impossible to have a reasoned, rational assessment of anything because so many things are obscured, obfuscated. It's almost as if some people, and this is, I think you can tell me if you disagree, but it seems to me that many people think that you can't really ever assess or evaluate anything scientifically because on the one hand, there's things that are lied about or talked, and then on the other hand, is it even possible to have an objective account of what's happened? I mean, how do you see that, first of all?
Well, I mean, you know, in a sense, yeah. So to be clear, the book, you know, we never at any point in the book form scientific judgments. You know, I'm a historian. Thomas is a journalist, but he specializes a lot in economics. So, you know, we come from that perspective. What we have done instead is rather than form a judgment about scientific fact, form a judgment about how, if you like, a discourse of science was developed and the political framework of that and the dimension of power and politics and of economic interests which have shaped the way in which what we call the COVID consensus emerged. So those are quite different things. And, you know, yes, it's true. You can say, well, we're going to have to assess this, you know, for years. It's going to take a long time looking at all the detail until we can form a, you know, a more objective view. And I don't really agree with that in a way, because one thing we have seen in the last few years is the most unbelievable data frenzy. You know, there's data coming out of our ears. And as you know very well, Alan, you know, that data is quite clear, actually, as to, you know, whether lockdowns were particularly effective. And looking at excess deaths, comparing Sweden to other countries, and in Latin America, as we do in the book, comparing Nicaragua, which had no lockdowns, to other countries. You know, data is actually quite clear on that. But, you know, even if we were to, but so we do look at that, but we do also say, you know, on the more kind of, if you like, hotter topics like masking, vaccines, those kind of things, our interest is really around the way in which the economic and political frameworks produce the outcome that we saw and how that is completely contrary to the scientific method. So we're not forming a judgment around scientific facts. We're just looking at how what happened was contrary to any understanding of the scientific method.
Right. So that's very clear. Thank you. So tell us why you think that the pandemic preparedness strategy was specifically there to deal with pandemics was jettisoned.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really, I mean, it links actually to my previous comment, I think. You know, I think as you and I know, and as many of the listeners will probably know, you know, there had been, for example, you know, a quite detailed document and study based on about 2 years of research led by Hong Kong University's medical school into pandemic preparedness, which had reported at the end of 2019. on strategies for mitigating pandemics, and it was based on influenza pandemics. This is quite interesting, actually. And it didn't mention the word lockdown once. It said, you know, for example, there are ethical considerations which are involved in populations where there may be large numbers of migrant workers. So making it clear that there are different frameworks where different policies are going to be appropriate. And yeah, as you say, this was completely jettisoned. So first thing, you know, a lot of people said, but this was influenza. So one of the reasons, you know, people say that this was jettisoned and we had to move to the lockdown model is, because COVID was completely different to, you know, this was all based on influenza. We shouldn't have modeled everything on influenza because COVID was a different. Well, interestingly enough, you know, we interviewed the lead author of this report for the book, Ben Cowling, at Hong Kong University. We're very grateful to Ben for having agreed to be interviewed for the book. And he said, well, one of the things he said was, well, actually, you know, they're different in perhaps in type, but basically the fundamental way in which COVID, coronavirus and influenza spread, you know, they're structurally very similar, in fact. So, you know, this is that's a pile of crap, basically. You know, that you know, the idea that, you know, we had to throw out these models because it was something unprecedented, because it was a new coronavirus, rather than, and everything had been based on influenza, you know, according to the lead author of the WHO report, that's not the case. So why did it happen? Well, you know, I think it comes back to what I was saying, as I say, you know, that basically that we had this, you know, it's the way in which the neoliberal capitalist model had evolved in the previous three or four decades, which had, you know, had produced real monopolies of influence and economic power, created bigger and bigger monopolies, and those and therefore there was a kind of economic and also a political project, if you like, which I think we saw unfold.
So I want to dig into this a bit more, because there are various views and thoughts, and you do take a view that it's to do, correct me if I'm wrong again, but just so people can hear how you see it, that a lot of the reasons for the decisions that were made were influenced and informed and maybe perhaps driven and pushed by this new stage of, if you want to call it neoliberal capitalism, or like kind of strength in big organizations, a bit like some people have said in the past, it's all about big pharma or big corporations, multinationals driving the agenda. Is that right? Is that too much of a caricature?
I mean, this is actually, in a way, I don't think this is controversial. I mean, you know, people like, you know, the great Matt Hancock and others have talked about the fourth industrial revolution. You know, and in the first edition of the book, actually, and it is in the second edition of the book, but it was even clearer, I think, and perhaps in some ways in the first edition, you know, because partly just because the book was shorter, said, well, you know, this is clearly a struggle at the heart of the way that neoliberal capitalism was evolving. You know, what we saw quite clearly in 2020 was, you know, that taking shape, because, you know, on the one hand, you had the old economic interests through which the liberal capitalist model had traditionally operated: small businesses, high street stores, you know, and also the interests which and you know, the kind of media interests which tended to promote those points of views, papers which in the UK context were the least in favor of the policies as they rolled out. And then you had the new economic frameworks coming in, particularly in the tech world, you know, and that is, after all, what people like Hancock mean when they talk of the fourth industrial revolution. And then, of course, a much vaster, you know, kind of, well, I was going to use the word propaganda, that's, you know, but it is in a sense propaganda, but certainly a vaster kind of media influence which takes place online. And so really that's not controversial, you know, that and in fact, you know, now as we see things unfolding, you'll often see people criticizing, for example, the lead authors of the Great Barrington Declaration, the professors Martin Kuldoff, Jay Bhattacharya, Shinetra Gupta, because, you know, they claim that the GBD is tied up with kind of old technologies. I've seen that said by, you know, leading figures on Independent Sage in the UK. So there is it's actually quite clear that, you know, one of the things that was taking place, it was a struggle, but at the heart of the capitalist model, between.
Let me ask you, just on that. Let me ask you, in an age where capitalism is not under any challenge, I can't well, maybe correct me if you think I'm wrong, but it isn't historically.
No.
Not with alternative models where people are putting alternatives forward for a different kind of society. I think that Margaret Thatcher's Tina, There Is No Alternative, seems to be in the economic sphere still prevalent. People can make money. Capitalists make money. Big industry makes money. Yeah. Explain that a bit more.
Yeah, that's a good question. Thanks, Alan. Yeah, I mean, I think obviously, exactly. That, you know, we're in a framework of investment. The fundamental questions are around how that investment is made in the first place, and how it is regulated. So what we saw, and so that's what a lot of the kind of political, if you like, sort of ideological discussions were like in the, you know, the previous 10 or 15 years. You know, there was all this discussion about, you know, in the UK from the conservative side of things, you know, too much regulation, we need to cut back on that. And from the quote left Labour side, you know, we need to regulate capitalism better to make it, to quote, you know, supposedly fairer. So those are the kinds of debates that were taking place. And then what we saw, of course, was the financial crisis in 2008. And that saw the emergence of what, you know, critics on the left rightly called, you know, disaster capitalism. And in fact, really the co-option of the state, the heart of political organization in modern societies, by corporations. So it was widely said, and I'm sure you remember, you know, so many critics would say, you know, this is, you know, socialism for the rich. So basically what was happening was, you know, these huge banks, you know, were so too big to fail. They had to be bailed out by the state. So they'd made all the profits and then the losses were socialized by the state. And there was a lot of criticism about that at the time. And it was about the way in which the state had become, instead of being rolled back, had actually, you know, it wasn't smaller in a way, its purpose had changed, it's the way it was investing had changed, the way in which the relationship between the state and its support for enterprise had taken shape, had changed, and it was effectively now supporting large corporate frame institutions such as banks rather than the smaller businesses, which had historically been at the heart of liberal capitalism. And that is a huge shift. And our argument in the book is fundamentally that, you know, what we saw in the COVID era was, you know, the way in which that had been expanded and taken to its logical conclusion, that, you know, it's not. And I think that's one of the things that happened politically. There was somehow this idea that this on the left, that, you know, this was the return of the state, Thomas Fatsy has written about this a lot, that this was somehow the return of the state, and this was this was an opportunity to win back some, you know, losses which had you know, people on the left felt they'd accrued.
Well, I want to hold you there. I want to hold you there just for a second, Toby. We're going to go to a quick break and we're going to carry on this because this is great, right in the heart of what is the state, what is the role of everything. Yeah. I'm Alan Miller. I'm with Toby Green. This is TNT Radio. We'll see you in just a sec.
For Boye Morich on TNT Radio.
Bill Gates has penned an op-ed for the New York Times saying, "I worry we're making the same mistakes again." He wants to create a global health emergency corps. And, you know, my response is like, seriously, dude, can't you just leave us alone? Why are you so obsessed with global domination? Can't you just go play Age of Empires and, you know, take over the world vicariously through the Age of Empires simulation? He just won't go away. Yeah, it's just the same old, same old. Give us more power to take over the planet. I'm, you know, basically Cobra Commander. And on top of that, it was also quite shocking this weekend clip that came straight from Tedros the Terrorist's Twitter account. He's basically saying our obstacle is nationalism, narrow nationalism. And he's basically, you know, basically between the lines saying, give us world government, sign the pandemic accord, and everything's going to be okay. They're so close. They're on the cusp of all-out world government, these freaks.
For Boye Morich on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Let's take advantage of the freedoms that we have while we have them to advance the kingdom's objective, to be salt and light.
Freedom is hard. Election security involves you, involves the voters.
This election
for people of faith is vital that we see a change, because the war against Christians is at an all-time high.
Transparency is the key not only to having honest elections, but to maintaining public trust in those elections.
Our ability to vote is not being withheld from us. No one's trying to stop you from voting.
The one place the American people can have a say is at the ballot box. That's why the Democrats and the far left are working so hard to get rid of all election integrity.
We cannot let our elections be anything but transparent. It is at the very heart of freedom in a free society.
And if we lose America, I mean, it's all over, because the world has looked to America for hope.
Free and fair at salemnow.com.
Support childhood slavery and buy an electric vehicle. We mandate that the truth be told. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Professor Toby Green, co-author of The COVID Consensus, The New Politics of Global Inequality. And Toby was just explaining how the relationship between the state and how some on the left thought that this could be a new moment. You were saying that, Toby.
Yeah.
I find it... Could you explain what you think the left and the right and the centre is today? I know this is really difficult, but just because these things have become...
One of the things about this whole experience of getting involved in this actively has been, is, you know, I've met some fascinating people around the world. One of the people I met is this Slovenian social scientist called Tomas Mašnak, who has been completely cancelled in Slovenia because of his position first on the COVID and then on Ukraine. But he's written that I've recently read a fascinating short booklet of his, and he actually gives a much better explanation than I could. So I think I'll just borrow from Tomas Mašnak. But in that, okay, what he describes is how, you know, basically this idea of the left and the right emerged with industrial capitalism and with frameworks of industrial production, as we all know, you know, the way in which the labour movement, for example, in the UK emerged in the late 19th century, early 20th century, is, you know, it's fundamentally tied up with production and the union struggles that took place in the 19th century in the mills and so on, with, of course, private capitalists. And then he's linking that, and then he links that to what's happening now. And of course, what we are seeing is, you know, a new framework of production, automated, and in which one of the things we look at in the book, as you know, Alan, is, you know, the way in which the distance which, you know, a lot of people in Western societies, and particularly among the metropolitan left, have developed from production and from economic framework, what used to be thought of as the frameworks through which economic value are produced. So that distance, you know, and Tomas Mašnak asking the book, is therefore this new kind of technological framework, is it going to be applicable to the same old relationships of left and right, which emerged out of the old? And I think that's a really valid question and a really interesting way of thinking about it. I don't really have an answer to that, to be honest. I'm nearly 50. I've been brought up, you know, with the old political balance sheet as we had it. And but, you know, when I look around at what's been happening in the last few years, it doesn't really seem very applicable. And that's, in a way, you know, it could be a positive thing, but it could also be a dangerous thing. We just don't know, you know, and that's one of the things I think that everybody's been feeling recently is uncertainty about these kind of things. Yeah.
So in the book, you go through the introduction, the politicization of public health crisis, COVID and inequality in the West, COVID-19 and the global poor, and then COVID-19 and the future of democratic capitalism. Now, just on this first point, and a public health, the politicization of a public health crisis, So there's all these different views about what happened. I mean, at the start, Boris Johnson had one sort of view. It did look like there was a U-turn. There was pressure from others, Sage and others, and internally, but also a very shrill social media, Twitterati demographic that perhaps would associate themselves with what they call the left, that was saying he was being irresponsible. He was going to sacrifice lives to let it rip, and the safe and responsible thing to do, and the considerate thing to do, was to protect society. And actually, much of the public was won to that argument after lots of, you know, nudge and fear and all of that. But so he had a different approach at the start, did he not? And then things changed. So, I mean, what do you think happened there?
Well, I mean, one of the things that we've got to also consider in all of this, and it links to this idea of, you know, the fourth industrial revolution. Now, this was the first pandemic in the era of social media. And, you know, coming back to the first question, I think one of the first questions you asked, Alan, you know, why did the initial plans get jettisoned? I think, you know, this is an important point. You know, things happen much more quickly these days than they did, you know, in times that we can remember. And that means that people, you know, how do politicians enact rational decision making in that environment? And that, and I think what we saw is that in the first real stress test of this, they didn't, you know, they succumbed to the pressure. Now, and of course, then you start asking, well, you know, and then what we also trace in the first chapter of the book is, you know, it's without question, I think it might be the second one, it's without question that there was a propaganda campaign. You know, we remember the films of people falling over, keeling over as if dying of COVID in China in January. You know, we know that that doesn't happen from COVID. We know that, you know, we don't know who made that footage. You know, there's lots of possible answers to that. We don't know where that footage came from, who did it. You know, some people said, I was once asked, well, you know, it could have been, you know, hackers or, you know, people at home decided they were going to make it. But then that footage was scrubbed from the internet. So why would somebody who'd done that on their own account want to do that particularly? Not entirely clear. But what we know is that there were, as you coming back to the point you made, and Laura Dodsworth looks at this really well in her book, A State of Fear, is, you know, there was a big nudge. And you know, when the stress test came, politicians weren't able to stick to the plans they had because they couldn't resist the pressure. And, you know, there are lots of possible answers around where that pressure was coming from, but certainly one which nobody can really rule out or deny is the role of, you know, the economic interests of corporations, which had a huge amount to gain from that. And we give a very clear example of that in the book, which is the famous discussion on Channel 4 News on the 13th of March, I think it was, 2020, between Professor John Edmonds, who became a leading figure in the UK government SAGE, at the London School of Trihygiene and Tropical Medicine, and Thomas Pueyo, who was basically a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and had no medical qualifications. And, you know, they were debating lockdowns, and Pueyo held his head in his hands at one point because Edmonds was still defending the previous consensus about, you know, the problems of locking down. And Pueyo said, oh, millions of people are going to die. And, you know, Pueyo was vice president of a company, Course Hero, which provides remote, basically online platforms for learning, which subsequently raised hundreds of millions of dollars from Wall Street that year. So there were huge financial interests involved in this. So, you know, there's all of that means that, you know, it was very hard for politicians to resist that pressure, and they failed. You know, that's all we can say. They failed to resist that pressure.
Okay, I want to push a little bit harder on what the so-called left or what they did within all of this. But just let me step back a second, because is it not true that the politicization of public health has been going on for some time? So, for instance, Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, banned smoking in parks on the basis of something that epidemiologically could never be corroborated, which is that smoking outside in a park can be passed on passively to someone else. Secondhand smoking. And then you could look at all sorts of things. My background was in the nighttime economy and licensing of bars and clubs. And I saw that the public health agenda was being weaponized around the idea that we are all vectors of antisocial behavior, a bit like the gin riots and the gin laws, that the public, this uncouth, great unwashed, was smashing each other up and doing terrible things, when actually people are far better behaved than ever before. If they're our generation, Toby, they'll remember what it used to be like 30 years ago. And so public health around alcohol-related crimes, alcohol-related behavior was being weaponized. And indeed in schooling, even on the arts council, a range of areas about obesity, tick boxes, public health had been instrumentalized in some ways in terms of the right behavior and the wrong. Had it not already begun?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair commentary, you know, and in the end, you know, I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, one thing we have all, I think, all seen as well in the last few years is, you know, health, science, you know, medicine, it is political. You know, the idea that it's somehow above politics is, you know, again, a pile of nonsense, you know, and it always has been, because it's fundamentally around power and control over people's bodies. That is, you know, one of the most political things you can have. And we certainly saw, I think, that, as you say, developing through, you know, the 20 years since the turn of the century. And in a way, one of the things we do also argue in the book is that, you know, COVID was, in a sense, you know, a lot of the things that happened during COVID, growing inequality, increasing reliance on tech, you know, the rise of the power of China, you know, a lot of these things were already there. And then COVID kind of brought them all to the surface and massively expanded their presence within, you know, our lives.
Yeah. So, but one question that people will put, and I at the time was very frustrating, that the government's opposition, what used to be called, I mean, the Labour Party has in its name the word Labour, but we know that over many years things have changed since Blair, subsequently, etc. But actually, the Labour Party could have, Keir Starmer could have stopped what was going on, but they seem to want longer, harder, more intense. Now you might, so, and you might say they don't represent any of the left anymore at all. But I wonder what you think about all of that, because they're not neoliberals, or are they?
Well, I'll tell you what, Alan, funny enough, I had a canvasser come around here the other week. I think it was last weekend actually, from the Labour Party, because it's quite where I live. It is a Labour stronghold, whatever that means these days. And anyway, I told her what I thought, but you know, it's really, you know, I certainly can't vote for the Labour Party in its present incarnation. I mean, having always, I would say, you know, been a Labour voter, and it distresses me. But you know, it's really hard to understand. And I think the only thing that it's interesting, as you know, there was, you mentioned kindly the positive review of our book in The Guardian by Larry Elliott. As you also know, we had a very critical one a couple of days ago. And one of the most extraordinary things from Richard Seymour, who's been kind of on a one-man mission to kind of discredit our book. And but every time it seems like every time he makes an attempt, he just makes it seem better. Because, you know, one of the extraordinary things he wrote in this article, you know, a man of the left, was, you know, that capitalism was suspended for a short time. I mean, you know, this shows no understanding of how modern capitalism works. And it's fundamentally because I think many elements of, you know, what has become the left are, as I mentioned earlier, now distanced from chains of value and chains of production. And therefore, you might think that if everything's online, yeah, capitalism has stopped. You know, and I presented the book at a conference organized by an offshoot of the Socialist Workers Party in London in October last year. And what the first comment was, you know, I was so excited when lockdowns came, because, you know, this was, capital stopped accumulating. I mean, like, it's genuinely incredible to me that anybody can still say that, you know, given that we know what happened in 2020 was that the world's billionaires became $4 trillion richer. And the only conclusion that you can draw is that, you know, this element of what has become the left have become distanced from production and, you know, economic value.
I did find it weird that from the very get-go that if you were working, like say the working class, but you could carry on going to work and you did, and then if you were a bit of the laptop class, you didn't and you got paid, and that you could do all these things even from the very early on. You're allowed to go and volunteer, which I did. Yeah, so somehow that was okay. But so there was all these contradictions, but obviously some people carried on working right the way through. Now, just to talk before we go to the next break briefly to introduce this theme, because you are obviously, you take a deep dive on the impacts globally. We're not just, no man is an island, as John Dunn said, and certainly the ramifications of this are being intense. Just briefly tell us how damaging lockdowns have been globally, and then we'll come back again to follow that on after the break.
Yeah, thank you, Alan. That's a really important question. Yeah. I mean, it's in a way, one of the interests that I brought to this was that, because I'd spent the previous decade working all across different countries in Africa as an academic with universities, institutions, and I was in touch with lots of people on the continent straight away telling me what this was meaning, which was that, you know, people were struggling to eat once a day, and any money that they may have managed to save up had evaporated. They weren't receiving help from the government. There wasn't furlough. You can't work remotely in an economic environment where 85% of the economy is informal. And even if you could, what's going to be the impact of lockdowns in areas where, you know, there's a lot of informal housing, a lot of poor, you know, a lot of cramped conditions? A city like Accra in Ghana, where 50% of the population live in, rather 50% of families live in one room. So, okay, you say, right, we're you know, there's a curfew, you've all got to stay inside, and this is a you know, an infection, a virus which spreads worse inside. And what we saw was precisely, in fact, that countries which had the most strict lockdowns in low-income countries, South Africa on the African continent, had the strictest lockdown on the continent, and far and away, the highest death figures from COVID. Peru, one of the world's strongest lockdowns in 2020, and has the highest COVID death rate. And that's what we saw. And that's actually not what you would expect from it scientifically, from cramping people together in accommodation. So, I mean, there's the medical impacts of lockdown, and then there's the socioeconomic impacts, which are devastating. And maybe we can talk about that a bit more after the break.
Great. So, thank you. Yes, we need to drill down on that a bit more, and also where we currently are with the democratic situation, the deficit of that or not, and what it all means. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Toby Green. This is TNT Radio. We'll see you in just a moment.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
What happens to a person who tweets out that homosexuality is invading the church? Well, if you're a 37-year-old Christian theology lecturer, Dr. Aaron Edwards at the Methodist-run Cliff College in England, you get fired. According to the Christian Post, Edwards, who has worked there for 7 years, told the Telegraph he was also threatened with a counter-terrorism referral by the school. Here's what he tweeted. Homosexuality is invading the church. Evangelicals no longer see the severity of this because they're busy apologizing for their apparently barbaric homophobia, whether or not it's true. This is a gospel issue, he said. And for that, the father of five got the boot for what the school called misconduct, which had brought the institution into disrepute. He argued that maintaining an evangelical stance was crucial for the institution's student base and heritage. Dr. Edwards is currently considering legal action and appealing his termination with support from Christian Concern. He also set up a crowdfunder where he's asking people to contribute if they wish. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
If you've smoked cannabis, don't drive for at least 24 hours. If you've smoked cannabis, don't drive for at least 24 hours. If you've smoked cannabis, don't drive for at least 24 hours. If you've smoked cannabis, don't drive for at least 24 hours. Even the smallest amount detected will cost your license. Drug drive and you'll get caught long after the high is gone. Think road safety. A message from the Government of South Australia.
Weekends with Alan Miller on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone. Just before we get into that, that last advert reminds me of a brilliant book I'm reading at the moment, Why We Drive. And regardless of what I thought about that particular advert, it's a brilliant book. And I'm going to talk a bit about that at the end of the session later on. But I'm just here with Professor Toby Green and a fascinating conversation about what just happened in the last 3 years, just a couple of days after the lockdowns were announced, the damages, the impacts, particularly in the South or, you know, the global poor. Toby, we saw all sorts of things, didn't we? Like migrations, we saw people that would normally be servicing people yeah. could no longer do that. How much is that still damaging and rolling out and impacting?
Oh, that's a really good question. I'm glad you've asked that, Alan. So you may have seen about 3 months ago or 2 months ago, perhaps, I wrote an Unheard about this, actually. So Africa, so some of your listeners may remember that, you know, a few years ago and in the 2010s, Africa was the continent, you know, the real booming centre of the world economy. And people were saying, well, you know, this is going to be the economic powerhouse of the 21st century. Africa rising was a phrase you heard around the place. And then now, if you look around, you say, oh, there's a debt crisis in Africa. Oh, you know, we're entering an era of austerity. And then people then, and some mainstream economists are saying, oh, well, you know, Africa was over-leveraged, it had too much debt. And now, and you're like, this is the consequence of what's happened. Because, you know, the reason that people are calling it debt, that's how the model works. You know, if you've got good future earning potentials, you take out loan to invest. That's what you do. And then when you suddenly bring that all to a halt, where 85% of your economy is informal, and people have to move around for that. They have to. That's what it's based on. So I had my oldest friend on the continent, who I've known since 1995, believe it or not, I met him in a bicycle repair yard in a small town in Guinea-Bissau, and we're still in touch. And he was middle class. He had a job going on his motorbike down to the coast. It was about a 3-hour ride, picking up, buying fish from fishermen there, bringing it back and selling it. And he was doing well. And you know, that is the lifeblood of economic life in many countries around the world. And if you just take that away, people, you know, what do they do? Well, first of all, you know, they sell the assets they have to try and make money, and then you know, that's it, capital's gone. And that's the impact we're now seeing in Africa, suddenly being seen as a place with a debt crisis, which that debt crisis is actually a symptom of the fact that it was doing very well in the 2010s. And what the impact of that is, you know, that the informal economy has not recovered. So I've been working with him, actually, with this old friend of mine, Mamadou. He's been making a series of films for Collateral Global, which some of your listeners may know, as an organization which, you know, we're trying to produce footage, just document really what's been happening around the world. Yeah. With COVID, and he's making a series of films for us about the impacts of that. And you know, and the latest one, which was published a couple of weeks ago, was, you know, the hotel in his local town. What happened to it? You know, it's now completely overgrown. You know, before COVID, it was full of clients and people having a good time there. And he went around he'd done one of the market. You know, this is what's actually happening. One of the people he interviewed said, you know, it's, you know, things were pretty tough before COVID, but now it's impossible. We all know that, the interviewee said. So, you know, that's the reality. That's the reality.
One of the things, because there's so much to talk about this, and I'd really recommend that people get the book. It's a really monumental work, and I got to congratulate on it. I think we'll get to the point where we maybe disagree, but then we agree as well as we get towards the latter part of this. But I suppose the question I've got is that, that you look at what I would say are the best reviews of your book, and they recognize, they concede and they admit and they agree to now the idea that it has been enormously damaging. But that some of them, like Larry Elliott and others, would say, but that doesn't mean that perhaps we shouldn't do lockdowns, right? It just means that they are damaging. And so that question about a cost benefit analysis, that question about us being able to transparently discuss and debate what the impacts are, of saying people have to not go to work or have to have their mandate or vaccine passports, any of those things, or even indeed the vaccines. There's been a reluctance, hasn't there, to have a transparent, open, wide debate where we have costs and benefits, risks evaluated in the public. And we've seen as well that people's free speech has been encroached, right? And so I wonder, yes. So that's, we've seen that. I wonder why, from your point of view, those fellow travellers of the past, of the left, and obviously some conservatives and others, many others as well, but why are those from the left that had a principle of free speech and wanted that to be discussed with the public, why they were so okay and often were championing silencing people or saying, don't, you can't say that, it's dangerous? Well, why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, I think, I mean, it's a question I ask myself, to be honest, Alan. I think a lot of it does have to do with the fact, as I say, that this was a pandemic which took place in the era of social media, the first one. So one of the things interesting, you know, which I think I mentioned this at the book launch, which you came to, was, you know, I'd never done social media of any kind before. And I do think that was a factor in the view I came to, because, you know, as we all know, social media, you know, you have particularly on Facebook, you know, you have your wall. They tell you what to think. You tell each other what to think, of course, but, you know, it's a kind of collective view. And I'm sure that was a factor. And then, you know, the framework which then came, where it was impossible to, you know, make the arguments that I was trying to make. And I think what's very interesting is the point you make about the lack of discussion. You know, I think that's really important. You say that Larry Elliott wouldn't agree. I'm not sure you're right about that. I've actually opened up the article while we're talking, because I'm going to read you the last two lines of it. Larry Elliott says, given that the price paid for lockdown was colossal and is still rising, a period of deep reflection is needed. The argument that there was no alternative should be closely examined. So I'm not sure that's right, actually. And it's interesting that he's calling for a discussion. And what's really fascinating, well, that just doesn't happen, you know. And I think that's fundamentally for me, that's because of the enormous levels of contradiction. You know, if people who, you know, on the left start to actually critically engage with this, the enormous levels of contradiction involved in the response they're taken, you know, would be hard for some of them to really squarely look at. And so instead of doing that, you're much better off saying nothing and keeping silent, because then you don't have to consciously engage with those contradictions.
And a lot has come out recently, which maybe will get some people to change their views somewhat. But from the Twitter files to the so-called lockdown files, how much was any of that a surprise? How much was it a shock or a surprise to see that the government had spy units in the DCMS and elsewhere spying on us as though we were enemy combatants? I mean, to what extent did any of that...
Well, I mean, it wasn't a surprise at all. I'm sure it wasn't particularly a surprise to you either. I mean, in fact, in the first edition, I covered that, how in Downing Street, there were units from, you know, GCHQ intelligence involved in monitoring the people's movements through phone apps to see how effective the lockdowns were. We knew that. That was common knowledge, right. Public knowledge. So the fact that, you know, we knew that they were involved in that element of the pandemic response, you know, other elements in which they were involved too, you know, how that's not surprising.
And some people, so I'm interested in your take on this. Back to Britain, I mean, we saw a lot of things in different parts of the world. We saw in France and Italy and Spain, and then obviously New Zealand and Australia. We saw how it played out. We saw some very brave citizens challenging things. It didn't take the form of things, I don't think, right? You can tell me if I'm wrong, but if you think I'm wrong, but many of the people I saw on the protests in Britain had never been involved in politics before. They were red or blue. They were sort of, it's almost threw up a new group of people that are just kind of reacting against these impacts. But also some of them then went away again as well. What do you think that means? And alongside things that other movements that have come out and people said they were treated differently, whether it's XR Rebellion or Black Lives Matters or whatever, there was obviously other protests going on, the Sarah Everard, Me Too, a range of things. But what do you think all this means for people struggling with what went on, people looking at new things, trying to understand what our orientation towards the state, society, and being a citizen means today?
That's a really good question. I mean, I don't know. You know, I think it's something we all should think about. I think it does have to do with the way in which, you know, and you and I know this because of our age, but, you know, the way in which the internet has changed the way we think and the way we interact with people. And, you know, an interaction online is almost as real as an interaction in the street for many of us today. And that changes the dynamic probably of protest, for instance, changes the speed at which all that takes place. And, you know, there's often a sense that if you, you know, if you do something, if it's not online, it hasn't happened. And that, you know, I think comes obviously at the same time, we do see real things, you know, we do see real protests. So, there's a curious kind of incongruence there, which I don't know quite what it means for the future of human societies. But I would say that in terms of protest and how we're going to deal with the fallout of this, you know, I think thinking about that relationship is going to be pretty central.
People were very critical about emergency legislation, Coronavirus Act and others, but obviously it was not that was used to implement lockdowns. It was something that had been long-standing and that is in place and still needs attention, with the Public Order Act, Public Health Act. I wonder, what's your view now? Is it that there should never be lockdowns, and do you think that's how we would go about ensuring that happens, noting that, and you've talked about the fourth industrial revolution, it's often been cited at Davos and elsewhere. There's a book about it with WEF, although I think it's very superficial as it happens personally. But also the WHO, the World Health Organization, part of the UN, but less member interest these days, is talking about amendments to the international health regulations and what that could mean in terms of national decision-making about pandemics. How to tell us what you think we should do about this whole approach.
Well, I mean, I think one of the fundamental things is, Yeah, it relates to what we've been talking about in a way. You know, the real issue here is, I think, you know, is that we haven't had an open discussion about this and discussion is shut down. Now, just for instance, you know, as I mentioned, and as you know, the Guardian did this great critical piece on our book. Now, Thomas Fatsy and I wrote a very short letter. They wouldn't give us a right to reply. We thought we'd write a short letter. They wouldn't even publish that. So I published it on Twitter this morning. I mean, you know, so regarding pandemics, you know, unless we have an open discussion, what is going to happen if there is a future health threat? Which there may well be, you know, it's just going to be politicized along the lines that we've seen. And if unless we find forums for genuine open discussion about all of these issues, the WHO treaty may well go through. It probably will. But what will happen if it's then implemented is we'll just see, you know, greater civil conflict and a greater gap developing between the state and subject citizens. So, you know, that's a real problem. We've got to have areas for debate. And for as long as people, and as I mentioned, I think one of the reasons people don't want to do that is because of the enormous levels of contradiction we're involved. But we have to find ways to have these conversations. So, you know, that's going to be vital. Otherwise, you know, I think, as I say, that the health regulations, it makes sense to have policies on pandemic. We had policies on pandemic. It's fine to have policies on pandemics. You know, that's, you know, not a problem. But they have to be democratically accountable. And that is the issue.
Yeah. So I'm just posting your response as well, because I also thought it was a very superficial piece, actually, by Seymour, which he could have made some other arguments. So people can. How can people find you, Toby? Just read out what, if they want to see. Obviously, we know what the book's called. I posted it on site, but and you've also mentioned Collateral Global. We're big fans of them and the Barrington Declaration. How can they just? Where are you on Twitter and elsewhere?
I'm on Toby00Green. So that's probably the best way to find me. And you know, as you say, we're doing a lot of work at Collateral Global with new films. In fact, we released a film talking about what we were talking about just a few minutes ago. We released a film made by the Indian filmmakers Kunal Purohit and Abir Khan on the impact on education in India of school closures, which was closed for almost 2 years in India in rural areas. That was released on the third anniversary of lockdown, so that was just this week. So we're doing quite a lot of that kind of work, and you know, I'll definitely if you find me on Twitter, you'll see more of that kind of thing.
I'm just posting that as well. I retweeted it earlier, but you can see this here too. People listening in, I strongly recommend that you get this book. I mean, just leave us, if you will, before we're going to go to the news at the top of the hour. If there's one thing that you, what do you think is the most important thing about reasserting our democratic rights in all of this? Because for me, what it seems like is that the biggest concern about all of this is obviously there's the free open discussion, but there's also what role we can. And my view should be is the public should be at the heart of it. We, our thoughts, our concerns. What would you say in terms of how we now learn lessons and move forward, what we should do about all that?
Well, I mean, there are vast questions involved, but I think, you know, fundamentally, we need to, as you rightly say, Alan, you know, be together on it. I think, you know, it has got to be a collective framework, and we've got to understand what's at stake. We've talked about a lot of the themes that, you know, in this discussion, which is great. You know, the way in which the economy has changed, the way in which work has changed, technology has changed. You know, a lot of what we saw in the pandemic wasn't, as I said, it was the first pandemic in the era of social media. It was the first pandemic in which, quote, remote work was possible, end quote, for a tiny proportion of the world's population. And you know, this way in which the relationship we have with technology offers many solutions, but it can also cause problems. So I think we have to, you know, and working out together as a society and understanding how economic interests might skew answers to that question and how we can be aware of that and not allow that to determine our frame of discussion. That's going to be key.
Brilliant. Well, Toby, thank you so much for joining us. I'd love to carry on another time with you. It's an important work. Everyone should get it. It's on, you can see at Alan Vibe, you'll be able to see the link to the book on the COVID consensus. just before we go into the news hour, major questions in light of 3 years on since lockdowns, in light of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, the right to protest. We're seeing new legislation coming down the line, the policing bill, the online safety bill, outsourcing freedom of speech to big tech in Silicon Valley, a refusal to be transparent by elected representatives offer, not just in terms of this discussion, but certainly in terms of traffic management, urban plans, the 15 and 20 minute cities, roadblocks, intimately linked in many ways, the low traffic neighborhoods with lockdown, and ULEZ and clean air zones. After the news, we'll be talking more. I'm very pleased to say that Law or Fiction, Stephen Jackson's going to be joining us, and we're going to get right into it. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. Freedom is essential. See you soon.